Thanks a lot. Today I will talk about the Higgs and supersymmetry, and during the first lecture today I had a quick look through John Eller's lecture, and again I discovered a little bit of overlap, but again I think that some things one can also hear twice and it's still interesting. Or maybe it's even easier to understand. Okay, so today, Higgs and supersymmetry. First, and this is part of the overlap, why supersymmetry? Then I will explain in more detail the M-sys-M Higgs sector. And in the end, I will talk again about electric precision observables in the context of supersymmetry. Why supersymmetry? I know that John motivated this, but I have a few more formulas, and so maybe one can understand this argument even slightly better then. We know that the standard model is not the ultimate theory. Yeah, there's no gravity included. There's the hierarchy problem. I will come to this. And also, the standard model has no cold dark matter candidate. And OK, this plot you've seen yesterday. But I want to focus now on the hierarchy problem, where people always say the Higgs mass is unstable with respect to quantum corrections. Well, how does this really look like? We look at the propagator of the Higgs in the standard model. And the inverse propagator is then given by this expression here, I times momentum squared minus Higgs boson mass squared. And there are loop corrections, like this one here, for example. Fermion loop correction. And what happens is that these corrections here go into the propagator, or here in the inverse propagator, and appear as the so-called self-energy. Yeah? So you calculate this diagram, and then the correction appears here. We can look at the result of this calculation is given here. We have the number of flavors, and then the coupling constant, the Yukawa coupling on both sides, and the integral. And from the decomposition here of the Lorentz, from the Dirac structure, you get this type of integrands. And if you look, what happens if you push the upper limit of this four-dimensional integral to infinity, you find one part that diverges quadratically and another part that goes logarithmically with this upper limit. Yeah? And this is then where one says that the quadratic divergence comes in from this part of the integral. Which means that you get a correction to the Higgs boson mass, which can be of the order of this square of this upper limit. And you say, okay, if we do it very simple without specific regular renormalization, we just take some kind of cutoff to, I don't know, gut scale or Planck scale, then this correction to the Higgs boson mass actually grows with this upper limit squared. And if one compares, inserts here the Planck mass, and one can see that the correction to the Higgs boson mass is something like 30 powers larger than the Higgs boson mass squared itself. And this is, of course, very unnatural. And on top of that, it would give you a Higgs boson mass that is very large. And we discussed yesterday that a very large Higgs boson mass, so removing the Higgs again from the theory, doesn't work. Yeah? Then all the properties that have been introduced to fix, to get the masses to regularize the amplitudes of the WW scattering and so on, this would all be lost. So this cannot be. We need a small Higgs boson mass, and this adjustment to get a small Higgs boson mass again is also called the fine-tuning problem here. The reason is, I mean, we have massless particles, or we have particles with low masses in our theory, and why is it a problem here, not for the other particles? Well, for the photon, there's the U1, the electromagnetic U1 symmetry that protects the photon from receiving a mass. You can calculate all these corrections, and they're all zero. This is fine. This is a vector particle. If you go to a fermion, like, let's say, the electron, you can also calculate these mass corrections, and you see that you also find a dependence on this upper limit, but it grows only logarithmically and not quadratically, like here, and is also furthermore suppressed by the mass itself. Here, for the scalar particle, for the Higgs, there is no symmetry that would protect its mass from blowing up, and this is then what you find, yeah, that you get corrections being quadratically in this upper limit. Now, people were thinking for other reasons about supersymmetry and found out that supersymmetry actually might be able to cure this problem. Okay, I will say a few more words about supersymmetry on the next slides, but just the very first introduction. Supersymmetry, the supersymmetric operator Q acting on a bosonic state gives you a fermionic state, acting on a fermionic state gives you a bosonic state. This means that all fermionic degrees of freedom in the standard model receive their bosonic supersymmetric counterpart, all bosonic degrees of freedom receive their fermionic counterparts. In other words, if we start here with the left or right-handed components of a fermion, in supersymmetry, they have their so-called left or right-handed scalar partner. Of course, a scalar is neither left nor right-handed. This just reminds us where this particle comes from, that it's the partner of the left or right-handed component of a fermion. So in supersymmetry, as I said, we not only have the fermions, we also have their scalar partners. And if you have the scalar partners, you have new types of diagrams. You have this type of diagram, and you have this type of diagram here. Again, you can calculate the contribution to the self-energy, and you find, again, a part that is quadratically divergent. Now, we add up everything, and we see that all these quadratically divergent cancel exactly if the number of flavors for the scalar partners are the same as for the standard model fermions. Well, this was to be expected anyway, because this is how the theory is constructed. You want the SUSY partners for the standard model particles, so this number should be the same. And also, the Yukawa coupling should be the same. So here we would have the fermion Yukawa coupling, and the one for the scalar fermion should be the same. If furthermore, even the masses are the same of the scalar fermion and the fermion, then the corrections would vanish completely. However, we know already this cannot be. Yeah, we have not seen any SUSY particles with the masses of the standard model particles, so there must be a mass difference. We will come back to this. Introducing a mass splitting here by this delta squared, you can evaluate it, and then you find that what remains in the self-energy is proportional to this delta squared. Yeah, so this is the correction that the Higgs boson mass then still receives. And then one can say, okay, everything still looks fine. Our problem with the large correction to the Higgs boson mass can be solved if this correction stays relatively small, let's say order of the Higgs boson mass itself. Yeah? And this tells us already at which scale we should expect supersymmetry. It should be order of 100 GeV, 1 TeV or so. Not too much above 1 TeV, because then we would reintroduce the hierarchy problem. Yeah? So this is what we get from here. To summarize, SUSY at the TeV scale provides a very attractive solution, at least in my view, for the hierarchy problem. Okay. This is what I told you partially before. SUSY is the symmetry between fermions and bosons. But to give one more example, make it even more clear, if you apply the SUSY operator to a top quark, you get out a scalar top. If you apply it to a gluon, you get out the SUSY partner, the gluino, with spin 1/2. And this means that each standard model multiplet, roughly speaking, is enlarged to its double size. And okay, I also said this before, we have to introduce SUSY breaking in order to make the model viable. And in the first approximation, this is done by adding new mass terms to the Lagrangian by hand. This has to be done with care, not to reintroduce the hierarchy problem, but it can be done. There is a list of mass terms that can be introduced without introducing the hierarchy problem. And in the first approximation, you simply write them into the Lagrangian, and then you can work with this. And as I said, one should expect order of 1 TeV here. Yes?
Why is it
called soft SUSY breaking? Well, soft SUSY breaking, the term refers to the fact that these mass terms do not reintroduce the hierarchy problem. Why it was called soft SUSY breaking, I don't know. But okay, it has been done, I don't know, 30 years ago or so, and it's just the name for it. No, it has nothing to do with it. It has only to do with the hierarchy problem, yeah, or these mass terms that are especially allowed. Well, many people are skeptical about supersymmetry. They say the standard model works so fine. Is it really worth to do it? And you can have a very long list of reasons why supersymmetry or what supersymmetry gives you. And I think John also talked about this, so I can be very brief here. I only have a very short list here. There's the stability of the Higgs against high order corrections, what we just discussed. Unification of coupling constants, we've seen this yesterday. There is the spontaneous symmetry breaking via the, well, the spontaneous symmetry breaking via the Higgs mechanism comes automatically. I'm not sure whether this was also discussed in John's lecture. It was. Let me say it in two words. In the standard model, the Higgs potential, depending on the sign of the mu squared term, the squared term, the potential, can either have this shape, the boring shape that doesn't help us, or it can have this shape if the mu squared becomes negative. So what you have to do is you have to choose the negative sign by hand. Yeah, you have to introduce this by hand. In supersymmetry, under very simple assumptions, you say, okay, we have a theory at the gut scale, and we have, at the gut scale, we have everything unified. You evolve things to lower energies. You get out automatically that the potential has exactly this shape. Yeah, there's one term in this potential, in this, from this RGE running, that turns negative, and it's exactly the term that you need in order to get this nicely shaped potential. And in fact, this works only if the top quark mass is between 150 and 200 GeV. When John was talking yesterday about predictions of supersymmetry, I was wondering why he didn't mention this. It was, let's say, a prediction of supersymmetry many, many years ago, many years before the top was discovered, that in order to make this work, we need a top quark mass between 150 and 200 GeV. Yeah? And this is exactly what was found afterwards. So in this sense, the prediction of the top quark mass is one of the experimentally verified predictions of SUSY. And of course, we know that SUSY has a very nice cold dark matter candidate and many other nice features. At least for me, this is enough reason to consider this model for further investigation. The main players, the particles, summarized here, the standard model fermions, the quarks, and the leptons with spin 1/2. And here there are SUSY partners, the scalar quarks and the scalar leptons with spin 0. Then the gauge bosons in the standard model with spin 1 or spin 0. And their SUSY partners, the gluino here for the gluon, the electrically charged ones, they mix. They are the charginos, and the electrically neutral ones, they also mix the neutralinos. If you look closely, you see a few more Higgses floating around. We need two Higgs doublets. We will come back to this in a moment. We need two Higgs doublets, and therefore there are more Higgs bosons. And all these new particles, in principle, have their own mass scale. Yeah, there are some relations for the principle. You introduce these mass terms, and then all these particles have their own mass scale. And this actually is a problem from the technical side. If you do calculations in supersymmetry, you have to deal with many more mass scales, and this intrinsically makes any calculation more complicated. But there is no way around. Because we will need them later, I have this one slide here on the scalar tops and the scalar bottoms, the scalar partners of the top and the bottom quarks. I said before, we have the left-handed and the right-handed, the degree of freedom of the top in the standard model, and we have the left-handed scalar top and the right-handed scalar top as their SUSY partners. So here we have really two particles, left and right-handed, and they have a 2x2 mass matrix, which I've written down here. In the diagonal entry, we have here first these soft SUSY breaking terms introduced by hand. Then we have the mass term that we would expect naively from supersymmetry. Yeah? The scalar top should have the mass of the top quark. So here is m top squared. And then, I will not go into details here, there's a numerically very small contribution, a so-called d term, which is really numerically much less significant than the others, and we will not talk about this. These are the diagonal entries, the m stop left squared, the m stop right squared, and here m top squared. There are also off-diagonal entries. Here, they go proportional to the fermion mass, so here proportional to the top quark mass, and then this xt is a summary of several other parameters. I wrote it down here. There's another soft SUSY breaking term called at, which goes into the off-diagonal entry. Then there is the mu parameter that comes from the mixing of the Higgses and the Higgs potential. We'll also come back to this. And divided by 10 beta, which comes from the ratio of the two vacuum expectation values. We will also see this later. But anyway, this is the off-diagonal entry, and because it's proportional to the top quark mass itself, it can be very large. Which means, if you want to arrive at the mass eigenstates, you have to diagonalize this matrix with the mixing angle theta stop, and then you get out here the two mass eigenvalues. It looks similar for the scalar bottom sector here with the diagonal soft Suse break parameters here, m bottom squared, and then the off-diagonal entry is now mb times xb, and xb looks similar to xt, just with their own indices here. Now you would say, okay, the bottom quark mass is much smaller than the top quark mass, so here the off-diagonal entry is negligible. Could be correct, but it's not, because this piece here doesn't go with 1 over 10 beta, but with times tangent beta, and we will see later that tangent beta can take values of 50 or so. If you multiply this parameter mu, which is of the order of the normal soft Suse breaking parameters, with a large value of tangent beta, this can compensate the smallness of the bottom quark mass, and also here the off-diagonal entry can become large, and again you have to diagonalize it with this mixing angle and get out these two mass eigenvalues. One more word. The left-handed scalar top and the left-handed scalar bottom, they form a SU2 doublet, as do the top and the bottom in the standard model. And this implies that these two mass terms have to be the same. Yeah? SU2 enforces that these two mass terms are the same. You may say, okay, nice, yeah, one parameter less. However, if you count, you have here three soft Suse break parameters, this one, and AT. And the other parameters come, let's say, from other sectors. We have three soft Suse break parameters, and we have three physical parameters, the mixing angle and the two masses. In the scalar bottom sector, it's the same. Three soft Suse break parameters, and then three physical parameters. However, due to this relation, if you take the two sectors together, we have only five parameters, which are related to these six physical parameters, which means there's a relation between these parameters, which is nice and easy at tree level, but as soon as you do higher order calculations, exactly this relation has to be preserved at higher orders, and it's very complicated to set up your calculation that this goes through without any problems. I will not go into details here, but you can spend a lot of time to find a renormalization, for example, of the model that preserves this and still gives you nice results. Yeah, these, yeah?
Okay, anyways, can you
learn a little bit the SU2 relation? It's not the SU2 relation. This is the normal SU2 that we have in the standard model, which, of course, is also present in supersymmetry. In the standard model, the top and the bottom are the left-handed components, are the SU2 doublet. Yeah, and the Suse part is exactly the same. They are the left-handed scalar top and the left-handed scalar bottom are an SU2 doublet. And particles that are in the same doublet receive the same mass term. This comes from the Higgs mechanism. This is something different. This has nothing to do with the SU2. The Higgs mechanism breaks these SU2 in the standard model. Yeah, but here for the soft Suse break parameters, they are doublet of the SU2. No. The Higgs mechanism gives you these standard model particles. If you would introduce a Higgs-like mechanism also for these particles, this would reintroduce the hierarchy problem. This you cannot do. You can only introduce these soft Suse breaking terms that do not reintroduce the hierarchy problem. But if you would do it with a Higgs mechanism, you would get the problem back. Good. Now we come to the Higgs sector. Let's look at the standard model case again. And I've shown this in my lecture yesterday. We have this term here giving mass to the down-type quark fermions and to the up-type quark fermions. And in the standard model, you play this little trick that here we have the Higgs doublet, and here we have this other one, phi sub c, which has the vacuum expectation value upstairs. I think also John mentioned it yesterday. In supersymmetry, this is not allowed, because this type of combination of superfields is not allowed in the potential. Yeah, it has to be an analytic function of the superfields, which means you cannot have a field and a field complex conjugate. You cannot play this game here. Therefore, you introduce a second Higgs doublet. One can even think, well, maybe it's even natural. I mean, to me, this looks like a little trick or so, yeah? And if you use a second Higgs doublet, it's at least as natural as doing it with one Higgs doublet and moving the vacuum expectation value upstairs. So in the MSSM, we have two Higgs doublets, which I sometimes call H1 and H2, and sometimes HD and HU. Don't get too confused. There are more reasons why you need two Higgs doublets. There are the cancellation of anomalies. I will not go into details here, but also this requires exactly these two Higgs doublets. Well, this is how they look like. H1 and H2 with their components here, and here we have the one vacuum expectation value upstairs and the other one downstairs, V1 and V2, and then the field constant here. The Higgs potential, in the standard model, the Higgs potential looks very simple because we have only one Higgs doublet and there are not many possibilities how to combine one Higgs doublet with itself. Here we have two Higgs doublets and this gives us more possibilities, and if you write them down, you find this somewhat more complicated Higgs potential. Here we have soft to the breaking terms, M1 squared, M2 squared, and M12 squared. And here the quartic terms. This is something that you get in supersymmetry, which you don't have in the standard model. In the standard model, the quartic term is this parameter lambda, the last free parameter, which is directly related to the standard model Higgs boson mass. An unknown parameter. Here, supersymmetry enforces that the quartic couplings are given by the gauge couplings, which have been measured. So we know the quartic couplings. Yeah? This is something in favor, let's say, not in favor. This allows you to make predictions in the MSSM Higgs sector, which are not possible in the standard model, because the quartic couplings are known. And there was this one question yesterday evening, I think, what do we do if we don't find the Higgs boson below a certain mass range? If you would extend the MSSM by another gauge group, then you could get an additional contribution here, which would then rise or could move the Higgs boson mass upwards. Yeah, this would be one possibility. We will not talk about this later, just to mention that this is exactly where it would come in. Now the counting. In the standard model, we had one complex doublet with 4 degrees of freedom. You need 3 for the masses of the gauge bosons, or corresponding to the 3 Goldstone bosons, which left us with 1 elementary scalar particle. In the MSSM, we have 2 complex doublets, which are 8 degrees of freedom. 8 minus 3 is 5. This means here we have 5 physical Higgs bosons. The light CP even one, the heavy CP even one, the CP odd one, and the charged one. Now, in the standard model, we have one free parameter describing the Higgs sector, either lambda or the mass of the Higgs boson itself. Yeah, it's the only unknown parameter that describes everything. Also here, we need one mass scale describing the Higgs sector, and often the mass of the CP odd Higgs boson, MA, is chosen as a mass scale. And then we need only one additional parameter. One additional parameter is sufficient to describe the whole Higgs sector at tree level, and it has been shown to be convenient, let's say, to use this parameter here, tangent beta, which is the ratio of the two vacuum expectation values, V2 over V1. Yeah, just a convenient parameter. And with these two parameters, you can describe the whole Higgs sector. Which means if we measure the Higgs bosons at some point, or if we detect them and measure their characteristics and quantities, these two parameters will have to be determined experimentally. Yeah? This would be the goal, to measure MA and tangent beta. I think I have one slide on complex phases. There could be CP violation. This is the only slide I have on this, but I just want to mention it here. There could be CP violation. You could have a complex phase in between the two Higgs doublets, and also this parameter here can be complex. At tree level, you can, if you look close enough, you can rotate these phases away and set them to zero. This is possible. However, in having loop corrections, we will come to this, you will get a mixing between these CP even and CP odd neutral states, and then usually the mass of the charged Higgs boson is taken as an input parameter, yeah? If you take complex phases into account. Now, looking closer at the particle content, we had here the field content. and this field content still has to be rotated into the physical basis. We had the CP even fields here, phi 1, 0, phi 2, 0. They are rotated with this matrix here to give rise to the mass eigenstates, the little h and the capital H. It's similar for the CP odd states. They are diagonalized exactly, well, if you do the math, you will see that exactly this tangent beta that was used, the beta, exactly also diagonalizes this mass matrix. And you get out the CP odd one and the neutral Goldstone boson. And the same happens for the charged Higgs bosons. Yeah, you get out the charged Higgs boson and the charged Goldstones. Yeah. Okay, yeah, this I said already, the masses for the gauged bosons look exactly as in the standard model. Let's do the counting again. The parameters in the Higgs potential, besides the gauge couplings that appear in the quartic couplings, are the two vacuum expectation values and then these three soft Suzy Bragg parameters. So we have five parameters. Well, there's one relation between the W boson mass and the Z boson mass, fixing V1 squared plus V2 squared, which equals to V squared in the standard model. This gives us one condition. Furthermore, we have to minimize the potential. We have to sit at the minimum. And with respect to these two fields, this gives us two conditions. And this means from these five parameters, we have three conditions, and therefore we need only two parameters to describe everything. Well, this is the reason. And as I said before, these are tangent beta and MA. It sounds very simple, but there's a bit more behind. This means if you can describe everything in terms of tangent beta and MA, this means that all the other parameters, all the other masses, and the mixing angle alpha, for example, can be predicted. They can be calculated. Yeah? And this is... So you can calculate the mass of the light Higgs boson here. You cannot calculate the mass of the Higgs boson in the standard model. Yeah? You can calculate these masses and the mixing angle here. And there's... The most simple example I've written down here, the mass of the charged Higgs boson is determined by the square of the A boson mass plus MW boson squared. So if we ever find the CP odd Higgs boson and the charged Higgs boson, this mass relation has to be fulfilled. If we find a different mass difference, it's a different model. Yeah? This is a very clear and firm prediction by supersymmetry. Of course, there are loop corrections, we will come to this, which somehow modify this, but still, there is a very clear prediction for the mass relations. Yes?
If we calculate W mass, then it is the same as we have found, experimentally?
We will come to this. The last part today is on the precision of solvables, and then I will answer your question. For the neutral Higgs bosons, it looks a bit more complicated. This here is the mass matrix before diagonalization. And again, what do we have as input here? MA, beta, and, okay, the standard model parameters, yeah? The gauge couplings, or equivalently, the Z boson mass. They are related. You do the diagonalization with the angle alpha, and then you get out these two mass eigenvalues, where by definition, the little Higgs is the smaller one, and the capital Higgs is the larger one. If you do this little diagonalization, you find this nice and short formula. So here the mass squares are given by this expression. And if you look at this expression for a couple of minutes and you vary the parameters around, you will see that the light Higgs boson mass has to be lighter than the Z boson mass. Yeah, you cannot change or vary MA and 10 beta in such a way that you can exceed the Z boson mass. Again, a very clear and firm prediction by supersymmetry. Actually, when this was found, people really believed that, for example, with a LEP collider, one can test the Suzy parameter space. Yeah, because this Higgs boson has to be found. However, I said I will come to this, there are loop corrections that somehow push the Higgs boson mass upwards and keep the model alive. But we will see how naturally this occurs. Anyway, the measurement of the Higgs mass and the couplings will be, as I said before, a very important test of the theory, much more direct than in the standard model, yeah, where the Higgs boson mass appears only via the loop corrections, as I've shown yesterday. Here, the mass itself is a prediction of the model. Let's have a look at the couplings. and we compare them to the standard model couplings to see what would change in the collider phenomenology. For example, the coupling of the light Higgs boson to gauge bosons is given by the standard model value times a factor sine beta minus alpha. Alpha comes from the diagonalization of the CP even, of the neutral CP even sector, and beta is from tangent beta. This means this coupling here is always equal or smaller than the standard model coupling. Yeah, sine beta never leaves the range between minus and plus one. So this can be only a suppression with respect to the standard model. For the heavy Higgs boson, we have the same, but not the sine, but the cosine here. What does it mean? Well, it means at least only one of the couplings can be suppressed. Yeah, we have this famous sum rule, sine squared plus cosine squared equals to one. And if one of them is very small, then the other one has standard model strength. And so we cannot decouple both Higgs bosons from the gauge bosons. There's another coupling, for example, here, the CP even Higgs, the A and the Z boson, goes with the cosine beta minus alpha and a combination of gauge coupling and mixing angle. If we look at the coupling of the Higgs boson to fermions, light Higgs to B bar or to tau plus tau minus, again is given by the standard model coupling times a factor, which is in this case given by minus sine alpha over cosine beta. And this also, you say, okay, now it's sine alpha over cosine beta. But watch out. This factor is not bounded by plus or minus 1. This factor can become very large. If tangent beta is large, cosine beta is very small, and this factor here becomes very large. Yeah. And so the coupling of the light Higgs boson to B-type quarks can be much, much larger than in the standard model. And this will, for example, allow for new production mechanisms for the light Higgs boson at, for example, the Tevatron or the LHC. For the top quark mass, we have this factor here, cosine alpha over sine beta, which is, if you look at the parameter space, it's usually more closer to 1. The coupling of the CP odd Higgs boson, again, to B quarks or to taus, has the factor of tangent beta. Maybe I should have said this before when I introduced tangent beta. I can also say it now. What range do we expect for tangent beta? One Higgs doublet, the one with the V1, gives rise to the mass of the B-type quarks. The one with the V2 gives mass to the top quark type quarks. So you could ask the question, why is the top quark so much heavier than the bottom quark? It could be that the differences in the mass do not come from the coupling constant itself, but simply from the difference in the two vacuum expectation values. Yeah, that the coupling constant is the same, but that the V1 is much smaller than the V2, and therefore the bottom quark is much lighter than the top quark. And therefore a natural value to have for tangent beta would be m top over m bottom, which is roughly 40, and then you can vary it a little bit or so. Yeah, so 40, 50, maybe 30. This is a natural value. Another natural value would be 1. Yeah, you say that they are... Sorry? Another natural value would be 1. Yeah, you say, okay, the two are the same, and... Good. Yeah, so here, this coupling is enhanced with the factor of tangent beta, and if tangent beta is large, it can be much, much larger than the standard model coupling. How does the mass spectrum look like? Okay, here this is the mass of the A boson as the input parameter, and here these are all the Higgs boson masses. We fixed the Suzy parameters, we will come back to this in a certain way, it's not important right now. Tangent beta has been fixed to 5, why not? And then the different colors here give you the various masses. The diagonal, the black line, of course, is the A boson mass itself. The light Higgs boson here, given in red, first rises with the A mass and then flattens out and reaches the maximum value, in this case of roughly 130 GeV. We will also come back to this. At the tree level, we have this upper bound of the Z boson mass. If you have higher order corrections, you rise the upper bound, but still it cannot grow indefinitely. Yeah? There is still some kind of upper bound here, and this is shown by this plateau region. And this is usually reached already if MA is larger than 150 or 200 GeV. And this region where the A mass is larger than, let's say, two times the Z mass or so, is called the decoupling limit. The light Higgs boson mass reaches more or less already its upper value, and all the factors that I've seen, that I've shown you here, sine beta minus alpha, or these factors here, they go to 1. Yeah, and then if they go to 1, the light Higgs boson behaves standard model-like. And this is normally reached if you make the A boson mass heavier than, let's say, 2 times the Z boson mass. This is the so-called decoupling limit, because the light Higgs boson decouples to the standard model limit. In this limit, you see here that all the heavy Higgs boson masses are more or less mass degenerate. Again, I mean, I've shown you this mass relation between the charged Higgs mass and the CP odd Higgs mass. Also, the heavy CP even Higgs mass tends to have the same mass here. Yeah? A very clear and firm prediction of supersymmetry. Of course, there are always exceptions in some corners of parameter space. We will see a few later, but this is what you should. This is the general picture. Yes. Yes. This is the CP odd Higgs boson. This is one of the 5 physical Higgs bosons. And it just, one has chosen one mass scale, and this is, one has chosen the one of the CP odd Higgs boson, because it's convenient.
It is not necessary that it is the highest mass.
No, not at all. If you can see here, the A mass is given by the black line. In fact, it's smaller than the other two, by a small amount, but it's smaller. Or if you remember the relation for the charged Higgs mass, the charged Higgs mass squared is MA squared plus MW squared, which means at the tree level, the charged Higgs mass is always a little bit heavier than the A mass. Yeah, as I said, there is this upper limit at the tree level, which would exclude everything by lab Higgs searches. However, there are very large radiative corrections which go with the top quark mass or even with the top quark mass squared. And the very leading correction I've written down here to the light Higgs boson mass squared, it's the Fermi constant, and then m top to the fourth, which is a very large number. Yeah? Therefore, the correction can be very large, times a logarithm. And in the logarithm, we have here the scalar top mass, the Susi partners of the stops, divided by the top quark mass. And this is extremely interesting because here the Susi partners enter into the prediction of the mass of the lightest Higgs boson. If you want to calculate the mass of the lightest Higgs boson, you need all these Susi parameters as an input. Or in other words, the MSM Higgs sector is connected to all other sectors via this type of loop corrections, which are particularly strong in the case of the scalar top. And many people, including myself, spend a lot of time in their life calculating higher order corrections to this mass here. And okay, we will see where we are with this precision in a moment. I talked about this upper limit. There are more or less 10 parameters that are relevant in these predictions for the Higgs mass. I mean, you see that the scalar top sector is very important. You can assume that the scalar bottom sector is very important. But for example, the scalar electrons are relevant. Yeah, because the coupling is so small, they don't play a big role. Then we have MA and tangent beta as input parameters, and furthermore, the Higgs mixing parameter, the gluino mass, and another mass from the neutralino chargino sector. These are more or less the relevant parameters. If you vary them independently, you perform a scan over the parameter space, you find an upper limit of roughly 135 GeV. And yeah, this includes already the possible uncertainties that there are. I will show you later. The top quark mass, of course, introduces an uncertainty. If you see here, it grows with the fourth power of the top quark mass. If you vary the top quark mass within its error, of course, this moves also the Higgs boson mass prediction around. As a rule of thumb, one can say that 1 GeV error in the top quark mass gives you 1 error uncertainty in the Higgs boson mass itself, just by numerical coincidence. But this is how it is. And of course, there are uncertainties from unknown higher order corrections. We have not calculated all the corrections that there are, and this also leaves some room. But if you include all this, you get this upper limit of 135 GeV. And this now comes the advertisement break. This has been obtained with a dedicated code for this called Fine Higgs, which I also have on my t-shirt here. And if you're interested in this, you can go to the homepage. Remember the name, finehiggs.de. Yeah, it's the homepage. I have it here on the back of my t-shirt. And this code, you give the parameters, and then the code calculates all the Higgs masses, couplings, branching ratios, some production cross-sections, and so on. And it's very easy to handle, and I think it's a very useful tool. If you're interested, go to the webpage and try it out. Good. And if you forget the homepage, I said I will wear this t-shirt today. Now, about the relevance of the higher order corrections. This picture shows the light Higgs boson mass as a function of XT. XT was this off-diagonal entry in the scalar top mass matrix. And if you see that the scalar top masses are entering the prediction, of course, the mixing between the two scalar tops must be important for the prediction of the Higgs boson mass. And so we show the Higgs mass here as a function of XT. Blue is the tree-level prediction. And, of course, the tree level does not depend on XT. Yeah, it's only MA and tangent beta that are entering, which have been fixed to some values here. It's not important. It's just a generic picture. Then you take the full one-loop contribution or calculation, and you get out this green curve here. And you see a very pronounced dependence on XT. You see a very large shift upwards by here from something like 70 to nearly 140, so nearly 100% correction. If you take into account the two-loop corrections and even a little bit of three-loop, this goes down again to this red line. And this is then, or was when we did this plot, the best prediction. But I want to show you the generic picture here. You can ask the question, why is it so important to get it right and precise? Well, let's take this picture and compare it with the experimental limit for the standard model Higgs, which to some extent can be taken over to supersymmetry. If you would take the tree-level value, the model would be excluded. If you take the one-loop correction only, nearly all the parameter space is allowed. If you include the two-loop correction, yeah, only small parts of parameter space for this set of parameters is allowed. So the Higgs boson mass, with its precise prediction, gives you very strong restrictions on the SUSY parameter space. This is the point. I expected at this point that somebody from the audience says, what about perturbativity? You said there are corrections of order of 100%. How can this be? Well, there's no problem at all, because the tree level is just given by the electroweak part of the theory. It doesn't know anything about Yukawa corrections. Yukawa corrections only come into the game at the one-loop level, and they, in principle, could be of arbitrary order, and here, in this case, they are even order of 100%. What one would expect from perturbativity is that then at the two-loop level, the corrections become smaller, and at the three-loop level, even smaller, and so on. And this is exactly what we find. So everything is fine. Well, the corrections are there. Yeah, there we cannot do anything about it. The corrections can be small or they can be large, depending on where you are in the parameter space. And of course, evading the lab bounds, this excludes already a substantial part of the SUSY parameter space, but it also leaves a substantial part of the SUSY parameter space. The corrections are just there. It's, for me, it's good that they are there, otherwise the model would be dead, but, Okay, I think I will skip this here. Let's have one look at Higgs couplings. Here, for example, the coupling or the decay of the Higgs to fermions. Also here, loop corrections can enter, and one type of loop corrections I depicted here. You can have a kind of self-energy correction, where at the other side, you can have either the light Higgs or it can mix to the heavy Higgs boson, and then either this one or this one decays to the fermion. If you write down the amplitude, this is done here. We have the coupling of the light Higgs to fermions, and then this mixing term here, and the coupling of the heavy Higgs going to fermions. And in the mixing term, we have the mixing self-energy of the light Higgs boson and the heavy Higgs boson. If you explore this through the parameter space, it's possible to find regions where this combination here becomes very large. And there is a minus sign between the two terms, and it could be that the second term cancels the first one and can switch off, let's say, this kind of decay in certain parts of the parameter space. And I have one example here. Let's look only at the red line, because the red line is the best prediction. The others are approximations. We show the branching ratio of the Higgs to BB bar, so a very important decay as a function of MA for a certain choice of parameters. And one can see it starts out very large, as one expects, because bottom quark is the heaviest quark, and therefore it's a large branching ratio from the light Higgs. But then it drops, and it goes to zero. There's a logarithmic scale here, and then moves up and settles down at a somewhat smaller value. And here exactly is the point where this becomes very small, very large, and compensates the first term. So if one looks for the B quark, or LEP, for example, has searched for the B quark, we'll come back to this tomorrow, for the Higgs boson decaying to B quarks, sorry. If you don't see it in supersymmetry, it can be that either it's not there, or that you are unlucky and you are sitting in a part of parameter space where this decay is very small due to higher order corrections. Yeah? And this has to be taken into account, and was taken into account by the LEP searches. There were then flavor-independent searches that did not rely on this specific decay that covered this kind of possibility. Good. Two more slides on the heavy Higgs bosons. This will become important again tomorrow. I told you here, for example, the A boson, the coupling to B quarks, has this additional factor of tangent beta. There is another type of loop corrections that, let's say, came into fashion over the last 5 to 10 years, or was explored more in the last 5 to 10 years, which is given in the denominator here, 1 plus delta B. This just summarizes the loop corrections and is spelled out in more detail here. This delta B has a strong part, so alpha S over pi, and then as factors, tangent beta times mu times the Gluino mass times loop integral with the scalar bottoms and the Gluino mass here. And it has a part that goes with the Top-Yukawa coupling. And then we have here AT, this trilinear coupling from the scalar top mass matrix. Again, times mu times tangent beta, and the integral with the stop masses and the mu. What one can see here is both pieces go with mu times tangent beta. And this delta B can become quite large. It can be, let's say, easily between minus 0.5 and plus 0.5, yeah, depending on the sign of mu and the size of tangent beta. And if we insert here, for example, a minus 0.5, then we have another increase of the coupling by a factor of 2. If we have a plus 0.5, it's a decrease of the coupling. Yeah? But this can modify this coupling of the CPR Higgs boson. It also enters in the coupling of the charged Higgs boson to top and bottom quarks in a similar way here. In this way, there's a strong mu dependence. The mu parameter enters in the couplings of these particles via this kind of loop corrections. Okay, if we will come back to this tomorrow, but to prepare this and to finish this up, if one compares, for example, the production of the heavy Higgs bosons in one of the most important channels for supersymmetry with bottom quarks and the subsequent decay to taus, as I said, we will come back to this tomorrow. With respect to the standard model, we have an enhancement factor here of tangent beta squared, and then this 1 plus delta b squared, and another modification for the branching ratios. But from these factors in the couplings, I was mentioning this before, they can give you new production mechanisms that are not viable in the standard model, but they can be used in the MSSM and allow us to search for these heavy Higgs bosons, for example. And it's similarly true for the charged Higgs boson. Good. Maybe I... Yeah?
I'm a little bit confused about the parameters. In the start, you said that we can predict parameters, and there are some free parameters. So you made a model on the basis of... you choose some parameters, and then you made a model.
I'll try to say again, I'll try to explain again what I meant with free parameters and predictions. Yeah. The Higgs sector at tree level has two free parameters, MA and tangent beta, and everything is at tree level predicted in terms of these two parameters. If you go to higher orders, also other parameters of the model enter, as I've shown, the top quark mass, the scalar top masses, and so on. They all enter. But still, the Higgs boson mass can be predicted, can be calculated in terms of these other parameters, and is a prediction of the model. Of course, if you vary the SUSY parameters around, you get all kinds of Higgs boson masses out. But each set of SUSY parameters corresponds to exactly one light Higgs boson mass and one heavy Higgs boson mass value. So if we measure, hopefully in the future, the SUSY parameters, then we know what Higgs boson mass to expect. And this can be then compared with a value that is experimentally measured, and this has to agree. Yeah? Yes?
So how many input parameters does supersymmetry have, not just in the Higgs sector, but like the entire model?
If you take the entire model with all the complex parameters that there are, you have, I believe, 105 additional new parameters.
And no, but like input parameters into the
Yes.
Thing. Okay, so because this seems,
a lot.
The idea, of course, it's a lot, but I thought the idea of having some sort of like a beautiful theory is that you don't input any parameters, the theory should give you all the masses. So it seems like sort of a backward step from the standard model.
Yes, this is a very valid criticism, and I agree that nobody, well, I don't know anybody who would think that a model with 105 free parameters is the model that describes nature. What one can do is, and I think John explained it, and I will also, I think I have it later on, either today or tomorrow, one can go to gut-based models, yeah, where, I mean, we have the unification of the of the gauge couplings, which means SUSY points you directly towards the gut scale and says there should be some unification there. If you do this and you assume that at the gut scale you only have very few parameters, four or so, or three or four, you can evolve them to low energies and then you get your full spectrum, but depending only on four parameters, not 105. Yeah? So you can also describe everything in terms of four parameters, or even three, or depending on what model you choose at the gut scale. And then this, at least to me, looks much more reasonable than a model with 103 parameters. On the other hand, one has to be careful with this reasoning. I mean, if you would take the standard model and you say we don't know anything about all the couplings in the standard model, and you write down all the possible terms, yeah, you don't write only the V minus A, but all the possible terms of the coupling, you also have order of 103 parameters. Then you do experimental measurements, you see how the couplings behave, and then you modify your Lagrangian accordingly. In supersymmetry, we hope to measure all the masses at low energies. We will extrapolate them to high energies, see which unification we can find, and in this way reconstruct the theory that is behind and explain everything in terms of very few parameters. Does this sound convincing?
Are there any efforts to incorporate SUSY with theories of gravity?
Well, with gravity, well, for example, with superstring models, well, string models usually require supersymmetry as well, you can make the connection to gravity. I'm not aware that there's any model that really combines this so far, but in the end, of course, this is what people are trying to do. We are happy if we can unify the three gauge couplings that we have, and or the gauge forces. Yes?
Can you see, or do the supersymmetric particles have Mikhailov-like couplings to the Higgs that could change their mass?
In principle, this could be done, but I think I said it before, this would reintroduce this hierarchy problem. Yeah, this kind of couplings, this kind of masses would spoil the cancellation of the quadratic divergences.
Is there some motivation for those terms being not present?
Well, you construct the model in order to solve one problem, yeah? And then you keep the model as it is and you don't introduce something that you don't want and that you don't need. Any other question? Well, there's always the B option. Good. Electric precision observables. We've seen this slide yesterday already, and I hope you remember that via the loop corrections that are entering into the prediction, you can distinguish various models. Yeah. Yesterday we only looked at the standard model. Today we will look at the MSSM. This we've also seen. This was the status of the standard model for the mTOP MW plane. This was the prediction here, this green band depending on the Higgs mass, and this blue ellipse here is the experimental value. And we've also seen this plot yesterday, the prediction of the Higgs boson mass in the standard model with this blue band fit here with the best fit value at 87 GeV. This is the standard model. Now, how does it work in supersymmetry? Well, there are some advantages of this kind of electroweak or fits in the MSSM versus the standard model. For the Higgs boson mass. We want to see what can we do for the Higgs boson mass. Can we do a similar fit here? One thing is that we can use the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon as a constraint. I have two slides in a moment on this. We can also use cold dark matter, which in the standard model is not explained, but here we can use it as a constraint. We can also use B physics observables as a constraint. And most importantly, I explained to you that the Higgs mass can be predicted from the other parameters. Yeah, it's not a free parameter, but it's also predicted from the other parameters. And therefore, much stronger constraints than in the standard model could be possible. These are the advantages. Of course, there are also disadvantages. As I said, we have many independent mass scales. Yeah, we have, if we really push it to the limit, 100 free parameters. And a disadvantage is also that the Higgs mass can be predicted from other parameters, because it's much more difficult to entangle the various effects that enter here. Okay, we will see how we can overcome these disadvantages and how this can really work out. First, a few words on the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. I've shown you yesterday that there is a discrepancy at the 3 sigma level between the standard model prediction and the experimental value. What does it have to do with supersymmetry? Well, in supersymmetry, you have these two types of diagrams here. It's always the mu-mu photon coupling, which is what we need, with a Suzy particle loop here at the one-loop level. Either a loop with the neutrinos and chargenos, or a loop with a neutralino and a scalar muon here. Now, these couplings, which I marked in red, they go with the muon mass, but they can also introduce an additional factor of tangent beta. So if you evaluate the generic one-loop terms in the standard model, you would have, okay, coupling constant, then mu squared over mw squared. In supersymmetry, you would have mu squared over the Suzy mass scale, which is, of course, larger than the w mass, but enhanced with one factor of tangent beta. If tangent beta is large, let's say 50, the MSSM one-loop contributions of this type can be much larger than the standard model contributions. And so supersymmetry can easily give a large correction to the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. If one looks at a simplified formula where all the masses have been set to one value of M Suzy, you roughly get this one out. At the one loop level, you get a correction of 13 times 10 to the minus 10 times 100 GeV over the Suzy mass scale squared times tangent beta times the sine of the mu parameter. And if you remember the discrepancy, I've written it down here, is at the level of 28 plus minus 8 times 10 to the minus 10. So if one looks at this formula, one sees that easily one can get values between minus 100 and plus 100 times 10 to the minus 10. So Suzy naturally gives you this kind of correction here. This is nice. On the other hand, the anomalous magnetic moment for muon can also provide very strong bounds on the Suzy parameter space. Yeah? If you want to be in this 28 plus minus 2 sigma or so, this cuts away a lot of this parameter space. And in this way, you get very strong bounds in a very nice way. Good. And we will see how we do this in a moment. First, I will show you, if I talk about precision observables, I have to show this one example here. And it was also asked before about the W boson mass. We can predict the W boson mass in the standard model, and this was this green band in the plot that I've shown you before. Now, in our plot, the standard model is red, and this is the standard model prediction here, this red area here, top Koch mass and W boson mass. And we varied the Higgs boson mass here from 114 GeV at the upper level. Sorry, the blue band is also part of the standard model. Yeah. So here's 114 GeV, and here we stopped at 400 GeV. And this white area here is the one that has recently been excluded by the Tevatron. This is the standard model prediction. Now on the MSSM, there are more parameters that play a role. We did a scan over something like, I think, 15 to 20 parameters that are relevant here. And then if you do this, you get this green area here. And blue exactly is the overlap between standard model and the SUSY parameter space. Yeah? So in general, we find that the W boson mass is higher in the MSSM. The reason is very simple. The largest contribution comes from diagrams with a loop of a scalar top and a scalar bottom to the gauge boson self-energies. And if you evaluate them, you see that they move the W boson mass up. This is just what comes out. And generally here, at the upper limit, we have relatively light SUSY particles, order of 100 GeV or so. And here at the bottom, we stopped at something like 2 TeV. If you make SUSY even heavier, it decouples and doesn't give any contribution anymore. Yeah? So this is really the lower limit of the MSSM. And in this overlap, the MSSM set, we decouple supersymmetry, it behaves standard model-like, or the other way around, the standard model behaves SUSY-like because it has a light Higgs boson, as it is predicted by supersymmetry. Now, as I said, if you play the game with the precision observables, you have to compare prediction with experimental results. And you may remember how the result looked like, but it looks even nicer on this slide. At the 68% confidence level, the current result looks like this, which, let's say, looks slightly better for supersymmetry in this case. Yeah. What is the next one? Of course. This is only at the 68% confidence level, and then people say, yeah, but if you go to 95, yes, if you go to 95, this ellipse becomes larger and cuts into the standard model area. And of course, the standard model is still compatible. But as I mentioned also yesterday, this kind of precision observables favor light Higgs boson masses. Now, people might say, come on, yeah, you have this measurement, but okay, it's just a measurement, and who knows how good this really is. Well, if one looks at it from a historical perspective, this was the earliest value that I could find from the year 98. This is the current central value. This was the blue ellipse at the 68% confidence level, about 11 years ago. And then a lot of experimentalists put a lot of effort into reducing these two errors. And if one looks how this has developed over the time, yeah, there has been substantial progress. But if you compare this to the central value, it's not a random central value. Yeah, it really somehow it zooms in. Oops. Yeah, this is where we are. No, this is where we've been a few weeks ago, and then the W boson mass became even more precise, and then oops, became a bit smaller. This is where we are. It's not simply a random value. Yeah, it really was a long effort by the experimental community to get this value out, and as you can see, it doesn't move around randomly. It's really quite fixed, and therefore, I think it's a very powerful tool that one can use. The central value for the W boson mass is 80.399 GeV with an error of 23 MeV, and for the top quark mass, it's 173.1 plus minus 1.3. The kink. Okay. When we do the scan over the SUSY parameter space, don't take it too seriously, the kink, yeah? In principle, one can cover the whole parameter space here if one makes the splitting between scalar tops and scalar bottoms very large. I told you that the scalar bottoms and the scalar tops give the largest contribution. If you make the splitting very large, you can get very large contributions to the W boson mass. But at some point we had to stop, yeah, and we stopped at a certain value of the splitting. The details are all in the paper. And then you have only very few points. I mean, we sampled 100,000 points or so, and then you still get only very few points here, but you get them. And then in order to get it more or less right, we put in this little kink here, but it has no real relevance. It's, if we would have chosen this splitting a little bit differently or the limit a bit differently, this would also look a little bit differently, but it's really not that important.
Ben,
yes?
I mean, I think you made a little bit too much about this agreement because, as you know, from our conference to the next, most of the measurements are actually the same. It's just one new which comes out and one old which drops out. So you expect all these ruminances to basically stay put.
Yeah, this is what we expect, but it... Well, I just want to show that there is not a random fluctuation and at some point maybe we are here, at some other point we are here, yeah? This is not the case, but that it really moves around smoothly and not randomly and strongly.
The way this number is done due to the average that can actually happen, unless there is a new method which is so much more precise than the others.
Well, now that you mentioned it, I don't have the plot here, but there was a paper by a few friends of mine, Langfeld, Moch, and Uwe. They used a new method to determine the top quark mass. They determined the running top quark mass from Tevatron data and not the top quark pole mass as it's done normally. And then they converted the running top quark mass to the pole mass, and I did also this plot, I don't have it here, but I did exactly this plot for them, and what you find is that this blue ellipse here is somewhere here. So, much stronger in the SUSY area. If you want to have a new method, then this is the example I can give you. Yeah? But it still looks good for SUSY. Good. This was the current situation. If the Tevatron continues running, we hope to get down in the top quark mass to 1 GV, in the W mass maybe 20 GV, then the blue ellipse would shrink to this black ellipse. If you go to the further future and include LHC data, the black ellipse can shrink further. With ILC or this GigaZ option that I mentioned yesterday, would get down to this very little red ellipse here, just to show you the power of precision observables. Of course, the central value of these future ellipses is completely random, can be anywhere, I just kept it where the current central value is, but the size tells you how powerful these precision observables are. Now, we said, how can we use all these indirect constraints? We have electrical precision data. We have B-physics observables, we have cold dark matter. Can we combine all this? Of course, it would be nice to combine it, yeah, to have the most powerful constraints possible. Well, let's look at the W boson mass, for example. I told you, you can get information on the scalar top or scalar bottom masses. If you go to a different part of parameter space, you may get information on MA and 10 beta. Anomalous magnetic moment of the muon. You can get information on tangent beta, I've shown you the formula, and the masses that are in the game, neutralino and charge-ino masses, and or smuon and sneutrino masses. But largely, this is a completely different set compared to this one here. B-physics observables, look at B2S gamma. I didn't show you the diagrams, but I'm sure Gino will do this. You will see that it depends largely on tangent beta and, for example, the charged Higgs boson mass. Or also the scalar top mass and the Charge-ino mass enters. Again, a different set of parameters. If we look at cold dark matter, John explained that cold dark matter could easily be explained with the lightest neutralino. So the neutralino mass enters here. And then, depending on the mechanism to get the cross sections right, the Stau masses could enter, or the A mass again. But these are all different sets, yeah, and it's very difficult, therefore, to combine these various informations, and therefore, the combination so far, at least, only makes sense if all the parameters are connected, and this brings us back to these gut-based models that I mentioned before. Yeah? You have to go to gut-based models where you have only a few parameters that connect all the different parameters to make these fits possible. There are two models, and I think also John mentioned them. I will just briefly tell you again what the parameters are. There is the constrained MSSM, also sometimes called minimal supergravity, but we call it the constrained MSSM, where we have 4.5 parameters. We have 3 parameters at the grand unification scale, M0, universal scalar mass parameter, M1/2, universal Gaugino mass parameter, and A0, a universal trilinear coupling at the gut scale. And then at low energies, we have tangent beta, the ratio of the two Higgs vacuum expectation values. And the sine of the mu parameter would still be free. However, if you remember, the formula for the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon was proportional to the sine of the mu parameter. We know that the contribution should be positive in order to cure this discrepancy. Therefore, only a positive mu would be the right one, or one can say, if this is really correct, this measurement of the g minus 2, then this sign has already been measured to be positive. And in what we did in our analysis, we always used a positive mu. And the particle spectra you get from the normalization group running to the weak scale. No, I don't have a plot here. Yeah, you have this at the gut scale. You run down to the weak scale and get all your masses and mixing angles and so out in terms of these few parameters. The other model that we looked at is the non-universal Higgs mass model, where the assumption is that there is no unification of the scalar fermion and scalar Higgs parameters at the gut scale. Because what do they have to do with each other? Yeah, I mean, it's nice to have only one scalar mass there, but these are two different sectors, and it's a valid assumption to take two different parameters for these two sectors at the gut scale. Effectively, what this means is that besides the CMSM parameters, one has one more free parameter at the electroweak scale. Yeah, one can trade this gut parameter for a parameter at the electroweak scale, and this is then either MA or mu. Yeah? As additional free parameter. Another model, just to complete this, would be the NUHM2, where the assumption would be that there is that even the two Higgs parameters at the gut scale are not the same, that they are distinct, which effectively then gives us another free parameter at the electroweak scale, and then you have MA and mu as free parameters. But in what I will show you, I will concentrate on the constrained MSSM and here on the NUHM1. And yeah, now we come to the prediction. As I said, we take these two models with only three or four parameters and tangent theta. We combine all the electroweak data as in the standard model. We also vary the respective standard model parameters, yeah, top mass, alpha s, and so on. So this is very close to the blue band fit that is always done by the lab electroweak working group. We include B physical observables, we combine it with cold dark matter and with G minus 2, and then we scan the full parameter space. And in this way, we get out the preferred Higgs boson mass value as it's done in the standard model. And I want to mention here, these are the authors of this paper, and it's a collaboration between theory and experiment, and I want to advertise this. It's really very healthy to do this. Yeah. We need the expertise from both sides, and only with this collaboration we can make this thing working. And I think it was a very good idea to do it. Yeah. Good. And this is now the result in the constrained MSSM. It's not a blue band, it's a red band that we put here. This here is the delta chi-squared curve. The best fit value here is at 108 GeV. With an experimental error of plus minus 6 GeV and a theoretical error of 1.5 GeV. And the theoretical error is given by this red band here. What can we see? First of all, the central value comes out much higher than in the standard model. In the standard model, the blue band had a central value of 87 GeV. Now we are here at 108 GeV. So it's much closer to the lab bound. In fact, the lab bound, which is shown here by this yellow area, can exactly be applied also in the constrained MSSM. Yeah? The parameters are such in this model that the standard model bound is valid. We can also see that going here to the side, some of the experimental error and a little bit of theoretical error also easily avoids the lab bound. Yeah? So this is the curve. Looks already nice. It's more or less as good as in the standard model to avoid the lab bound. This part here, I think it was also discussed yesterday a bit, is theoretically inaccessible, which means no matter how much you vary the parameters, you cannot get a Higgs mass in this region here. Okay, so this was the fit within the constraint MSM. Looks already nice, but okay, you're still, the best fit value is still below the lab bound. If you go to the NUHM1, the result is this one here. where the best fit value is at 121 GeV, with a somewhat asymmetric error here, so this one. And we see that this model completely naturally gives us a Higgs boson mass outside the lab bound, yeah, contrary to the standard model. So all the electroweak and B physics data, G-2 and cold dark matter, they point us towards the Higgs boson mass of 120 GeV. Yeah? There's no unnatural moving up the Higgs boson mass or so. Yeah, this comes out naturally above the lab limit. And with this, I conclude for today. This is your chance. Yeah, yeah.
So you showed these precision measurements. It looks like a lot of them are being improved upon, except for G-2, which is very interesting. Why isn't the physics community pushing harder? You both on the theory and the experiment.
I don't know whether everybody could hear this. You are asking why there's not more effort for G-2 to get this more precise, let's say. This was your question, right? In fact, there is a lot of effort. I mean, we have to come from both sides, from the theory side and from the experimental side. From the experimental side, there are new proposals. I mean, it was a shame. The experiment was running nice at Brookhaven Lab, but then they couldn't afford these, I don't know, it was a few million dollars per year. Yeah, it was basically nothing. But, they just invaded Iraq and everything, not a lot of money, and so they closed this experiment down. They could have done somewhat better. They are thinking about a new version of this experiment. This is seriously discussed, which could half the error, more or less. This would be great. And also from the theory side, there are a lot of efforts going on. I mean, not every week a paper appears, but there are some of the issues I mentioned yesterday, the light-by-light scattering, or also these efforts for the hadronic contribution, for this delta-alpha contribution there, either with the plus and minus or the tau data. People are investigating this. People are working on how to improve the tau data, or how to get the tau data better under control. There are new measurements for the plus and minus data that are taken into account. Barbar just provided new data. It will be taken into account. And so there is a lot of effort, and there is hope that in, let's say, 5 to 10 years, we could have a value that is better by a factor of 2.
What I understood is that there are a lot of possibilities of parameters, but nature actually chose one set of parameters, so we experimentally actually try to find that set of parameters. So, because I remember beyond standard model, they were saying that when this Big Bang happened, when there were 10^10^140 possibilities of parameters, mm-hmm. and there was only one set of parameters which needed to.
This refers probably to the general constants of nature. Yeah, if we talk here in supersymmetry, all these parameters, these I don't know 100 or 4 or whatever. Yeah, of course, at maximum one set can be realized. Yeah, and it will be our obligation and our fun, I hope, yeah, to measure these parameters and to connect everything together. Yeah, what on top of this will tell us afterwards, I don't know. Yeah.
I just would like to understand this model. How many parameters go into this N to H, N1?
These are the M0, M1/2, and A0 as gut parameters, tangent beta as low energy parameters, and then one parameter more. And I think we varied the gut scale parameter. Yeah, there's this Higgs, the scalar Higgs parameter at the gut scale was taken as an additional free parameter.
If you have M0, for example, right, what is the value of M0 here, or the other way around? What is this, the size of the mass of the scalar force? I mean,
You should have come to John's lecture yesterday. He showed... No, it doesn't matter, I can tell you. We did all this, of course, yeah? And if I remember correctly, M0 here is 100-something, M1-half, which is more important for the scalar quarks as a mass parameter from the RGE running, is at the level of 300. Tangent beta is 11. A0, in this case, is 1,100 or 1,300. Yeah. And the A boson mass is 310 or something like that. Yeah, I mean, you can try to look up the spectrum in John's talk. If this model would be realized, then our fit tells us that a lot of particles are in reach of the LHC. I have so many bets. We can talk about this tonight, yeah? No, a good bottle, yeah, Lagavulin.
Okay, so any more questions? Okay, so one final announcement, which is that Sven's, your light reading awaits you, so here are Sven's lectures. And also, for those who missed them, there's the second part of John's